great Kay Gardner. This is a short solo flute piece called Inner Mood, and we wish you all a peaceful, safe, and healthy end of the day and entire month, and let's hope that by the time we meet again, we'll have made a little bit of progress in the right direction. My name is Laura Yaris. I've been your co-host. This is Older Women Live, CKUT 90.
Good evening and welcome to Amandla here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Amandla is your 1 hour of African current affairs. And well, tonight it's kind of a solo show, actually. Doug, thank you. You have put together a lovely lineup. Could you let us know what's in store for tonight?
Well, it is November 11th, and I've always sort of paid tribute on November 11th to the Second World War. I'm a child of the Second World War. I was born literally that many months that it takes after my dad got off the troop ship in July 1946. And so I grew up reading the comics all about war, the vilifying the Germans and the Japanese with all sorts of racist language. Oh my gosh, that racist language. It was so bad. And yet, there was no reflection on all the other aspects of war, but glorifying the military and the brave soldiers and so on. And so I've got a tradition whenever November 11th comes around of trying to broaden that spectrum to remembering all the victims of war, and to not glorify, but condemn war. Let's be very clear that it's bad, and we want to get peace, not war. And bigger budgets and more planes are not going to bring us peace. So I've got my little background piece, and of course I'll link it to the elections that have just gone in the States, because there's a direct link. And then just the day after the elections in the States on November 3rd, November 4th, the federal government of Ethiopia invaded the northern section on the Eritrean side, the Tigray section, the second largest or third largest population of Ethiopia is Tigrayan, and they were the ones who ran Ethiopia in a military dictatorship for many years, and the majority populations, Oromo and Amhara, were sidelined. Well, now they've gone home, and they're not giving up that power so easily. They've got their militias and so on. It's a complicated situation, but it's also a one that could have a huge impact on the Horn. So I'm going to take a look with an Al Jazeera panel, which includes some very very informed people, including the Minister of Democratization. So they're going to comment on what's going on there. So that's really what I've got for this week at Amandla.
Well, then stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Colors that you fly, love just one nation, and the whole world we divide. You say you're sorry, it's no other choice. God bless the people now. Raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. necessary madness. Smell of flesh and burning pain. So I sing out to the masses. Stand up if you're still sane. All of us gone crazy. I sing this one refrain. We can chase down all our enemies. Bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces. But we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa.
Today is the 11th of November, 2020. Let us remember all the victims of war. The song I opened with is by Michael Franti of Spearhead. Rather than the sad and doleful tones of the traditional trumpet last post played at Remembrance Day ceremonies across North America, Franti is angry at the way war is perpetuated. His song focuses on the real victims of war who should be commemorated, the children, women, and non-combatants. I honor the memory of the fallen soldiers and respect the pain and suffering they went through. My dad was a veteran of the Royal Canadian Air Force who served overseas during World War II, and yet we could never get him to talk about the experience. I also respect the people who lost their lives and honor their sacrifice, especially in the case of World War II. The pre-war fascism produced some horrific realities to merit the commitment to fight and eliminate it. However, I'm not some sort of non-violence practitioner. I'm proud of my dad for leaving his pacifist Mennonite family tradition to fight against Nazism and fascism, and I support the right of people in just struggles to take up arms against their oppressors. I was in Lusaka at the height of the wars in Namibia, Zimbabwe, and South Africa, 1975 to 79, and lost many dear comrades who were struggling for freedom, justice, and equality. The fighters died in the freedom struggle, but children, boys and girls in their thousands, were slaughtered in the refugee camps by weapons sold to the racist South African and Portuguese colonial regimes by Western countries, including Canada. Our rulers had no interest in justice for my comrades who were struggling against colonialism and racism, nor interest in the deaths of children. The media at the time, here in North America, carried nary a picture of their slaughter. Their deaths were so unremarkable to corporate interests. The profits of their businesses are primordial. Large numbers of Canadians promoted the struggle for freedom, justice, and equality for African people in Angola, Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, Southern Rhodesia, and South Africa. They were ignored by the governments of Lester Peace and Pierre Trudeau, who played subservience to their corporate taskmasters. In addition to the soldiers who died in war, there are many militants who never wear uniforms and who wage unrelenting struggle to help people confront the abuses of the exploitative system we live under. We should remember them too. The young people who fought the Second World War on behalf of the rulers were combating fascism. However, the elements that made fascism a force in Europe in the 1930s and 1940s are present, but this time right inside our own homes. Jingoistic nationalism, scapegoating and exploitation of racial differences, demonization of opponents, muzzling free media, militarism, corporate cronyism and corruption, disdain for democratic structures, authoritarian rule, anti-organized labor, disdain for science, disdain for intellectuals, law and order versus human rights and justice, alliance with regressive religions, manipulation of elections, and I could go on. The U.S. military myth also claims that the Second World War was fought to preserve democratic freedoms, but like all myths, there's a dark underbelly that glosses over the reality. The most recent American election and the popular focus on the man and superficial elements of the myth, make America great again, the wall, Mexican rapists, crime and punishment, God and religion, provides a distorted reflection of the true nature of America's history and its terrible role in the world. And long historical analysis shows that that U.S. role does not change despite the election of the Democratic Party candidates. U.S. reality is much more premised on centuries of colonialism, racism, and powerful white classes exploiting the land and its people. The country is ruled by a class of ultra-rich who are supported by the military, the financial, and the industrial establishment to maintain their wealth on the backs of the indigenous people from whom they stole the land and resources, all the working classes, and especially the minorities of black and people of color. That constitution was set up in the United States and enshrined as sacred and inviolable in 1789. There were no women present when it was founded. There were no blacks, no indigenous people. In fact, all the people who sat around the table were landowners, most of whom also owned slaves and indigenous slaves, black slaves and indigenous slaves. Clearly, they would not invent a political system that would go against their interest. And hence came the anomaly of the Electoral College designed to prevent the masses from organizing and overruling the landed interests of the wealthy. American elections fulfill Marx's adage that the oppressed are allowed once every few years to decide which particular representatives of the oppressing class are to represent and repress them. And, as we saw in the Black Lives Matter protest, military force disguised as police were mobilized to maintain law and order. The Trump brand of fascism cannot use the word justice, freedom, and equality. Military, America's huge domestic industrial complex, has tentacles around the world and alliances with some of the most repressive and vicious regimes imaginable. Saudi Arabia and its brutal war on the people of Yemen and its own people are freely supplied with heavy and sophisticated weapons by NATO countries eager for profits. Literally every country in Africa has an AFRICOM contingent and military alliances with the United States, not to enforce democracy, but regional stability in the war on terrorism by maintaining in power immoral, corrupt, and venal regimes. The stability of Africa needs will not be possible until outside forces and their militaries leave the people of Africa to freely decide their leadership and how to benefit from the resources they own. The more the U.S., France, NATO, and others get involved in Mali, the deeper that country sinks into chaos. Somalia is the hyper example of a failed state after U.S. and foreign intervention. Despite numerous changes of government, our own Canadian rulers are still committed to funneling billions of dollars into the military industrial war machine at a time when the world more than ever is crying out for peace. CANSEC, the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries, is the military business lobby that has made Canada one of the world's major arms dealers. These are things we must remember. We, as a nation, are contributing to the carnage of war around the world. Why is the atrocity of Yemen not remembered? Is it because the atrocities are being committed by Saudi Arabia, which is the second largest purchaser of weapons sold by the Canadian war industries? We need to remember that and protest against it. Instead of racist xenophobia, true internationalists seek to break down borders, humanize the world's economy and laws, end war, and combat the monstrosities of the system that the U.S. has imposed on the world. piece you just heard played is called The Third World Cries Every Day, and it's from the Drop the Debt CD, which is a compendium of songs by an all-star cast of singers from all over the continent. Well worth tracking down if you can find it, probably online, I'm quite sure. Canada has always been on the front line of sending its young men and women as cannon fodder, but also profiting from the sale of weapons made by our capitalists. Our racist and colonial past, as well as Canada's role in exploiting people of color all over the world, must also be included in our remembrance if we are to build a nation of respect for all people, the essence of real diversity. We do not know this history because it is not part of our taught history. It is an ugly side of Canadian history glossed over in the interest of perpetuating the war industries without any challenge. How can we remember what we do not know? So let us remember all the victims of war. Imperial wars have always used young men as the cannon fodder and the civilian populations as integral parts of the battlefields. We should remember the motives of the imperial leaders who send young men off to die and condemn whole regions to the terrors and collateral damage of war. The soldiers die doing their duty, but civilians also die. Women and children are recruited as child soldiers, porters, sex slaves, and women of all ages through all the war zones of history have suffered from rape as a crime of war. The imperial competition for resources still trumps the lives of poor people around the world, but nowhere more so than Africa today. A map of Africa shows imperialism hard at work and using all the tools of war to push its agenda. The shape and form and era may be different, but it's still young people and women in particular who pay a very high price for the power struggles of imperialism. They are Algeria, Angola, Cameroon, Ethiopia, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Cote d'Ivoire, Democratic Republic of Congo, South Africa, Guinea, Guinea-Bissau, Libya, Mozambique, Somalia, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Zimbabwe, Sudan, South Sudan, Nigeria, Central Africa Republic, Uganda. We could list almost all the countries of Africa. We must also remember the victims of war who are dying in the Mediterranean and on the open seas of the Atlantic. We at Amandla have covered a story of how for more than a decade now, thousands of refugees from African countries have paid with their lives as they take the perilous crossing across the continent, fleeing the wars in their homelands or the governments that wage war on their people. Eritreans, Ethiopians, Nigerians, West Africans, Libyans, in their desperation, pay with their lives, fleeing the death and destruction in their homelands. We must honor the memory of all those who have died, and we must fight to defeat the militarization of our globe and to instill a culture of peace. We must win this battle, and to do so, we must redouble our efforts. You can find more information about how you can get involved and how you can become active. You can explore some of these links. Here in Quebec, L'Échec à Guerre, le collectif Échec à la Guerre at www.échecalaguerre.org. They run a white poppy campaign every Remembrance Day to commemorate all the victims of war and to condemn the continuing militarization of the world rather than striving for peace, justice, equity, and development. World Beyond War is a global movement to end all wars at worldbeyondwar.org. Rosemary Whaley, who has contributed often to Amandla, is a dedicated anti-war, anti-military activist. We could help you get in contact with her. Project Plowshares is at www.plowshares.ca. They've been in business for a long, long time and have a long history of standing up and denouncing Canadian militarization. Ceasefire.ca is running a relentless campaign, especially against the purchase of the aircraft that would deprive the Canadian people of important funding for what would be needed to bring our society into a just world. So let us remember all the people who die in war, and let us commemorate all of their sacrifices, and let us denounce militarization, and let us promote peace at all turns. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Well, the world's attention was focused on the American election on November 3rd. November 4th, the Ethiopian federal government sent an operation against leaders of the Tigray region that could have devastating consequences across the whole Horn of Africa. Ethiopia is 115 million people. It's the second largest country in Africa. And the Guardian editorial sort of summarizes some of the difficulties that are involved with what's going on in Ethiopia right now. They start with their editorial on Sunday, the 8th of November, by saying, "What a difference a year makes. Just over 12 months ago, Abiy Ahmed won the Nobel Peace Prize. The Ethiopian Prime Minister had overseen extraordinary change in his brief tenure, though the Nobel Committee singled out the peace deal he had signed with Eritrea, ending an apparently intractable dispute. He had also embarked upon sweeping domestic reforms. Yet while the relaxation of intense political repression brought real hope, there was also fear that the improvements were precarious at best, with too much expected of one man." So there he was, now invading Tigray and imposing a state of emergency. The Guardian goes on to say, "This looks like a tragedy in the making. Ethiopia is a large, very diverse country with many different ethnicities, and the fragmentation of Ethiopia would make the largest state collapse in modern history. The Tigray People's Liberation Front actually led through a gerrymandering of ethnic groupings, were the leadership of Ethiopia for many, many years, and a brutal leadership at that. So over time, had built up a sizable, well-armed paramilitary force and militia in the home. And at the same time, in Tigray, the Ethiopia Army's Northern Command has its major headquarters, which includes many Tigrayan personnel. So trying to navigate between the country's rivals within all the ethnic groups leads to much discussion about grievances over competition for resources. And the relaxation of the tight controls under the EPLF, the TPLF, during the long period of their rule, has already seen an upsurge of violence and combats between ethnic groups. As many as 1 million people have been displaced since Abiy took power. And last week saw the murder of 54 Amhara people, including children, in a massacre which is blamed on the Oromo Liberation Army. So The Guardian goes on to claim that Mr. Abiy's extraordinary gamble with his 150 million compatriots will not only be devastating just for the country, but for the entire Horn of Africa, the neighbors of which are in the Horn are Sudan, South Sudan, and Somalia, where, in fact, Ethiopian peacekeepers are deployed. So they go on and finally wrap it up by saying, in Mr. Abiy's Nobel acceptance speech, he recalled his experience as a young soldier in the war with Eritrea. "War is the epitome of hell," he said. "Governments must press the Prime Minister and the TPLF to negotiate before more Ethiopians and perhaps their neighbors face that same horror." So what I've got is a short clip from Al Jazeera of, again, just this last weekend. The guests are Awel Alo, who's a lecturer at Keele University and a Horn of Africa analyst. Zadig Abraha is Ethiopian minister in charge of democratization. And Martin Platt, who's senior research fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. So here's that interview on that panel on Al Jazeera.
He's reshaped Ethiopia and won a Nobel Peace Prize. Now, Abiy Ahmed is facing a leadership test as he starts an offensive against the Tigray region. So, just what are the causes of tension there? And is Ethiopia heading for civil war? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohamed Jamjoum. Tigray's leaders have dominated Ethiopia's ruling coalition of ethnically based parties for decades. But after Abiy Ahmed became prime minister in 2018, they refused to join his single party alliance. They've also resisted his sweeping reforms. And in September, they went ahead with local elections, defying Abiy's decision to suspend polls because of coronavirus. He now says his patience has run out with Tigray. He's ordered a military operation in the region after accusing the TPLF of attacking federal troops, an accusation denied by the groups. It's feared the feud could lead to the breakup of Ethiopia, and the UN is calling for de-escalation of tensions. Emily Hsu reports.
It was business as usual in the Ethiopian capital, but many here are on alert as an armed conflict simmers in the north of the country.
We're not people who fight and kill each other. Therefore, I personally feel that the Tigray and federal governments should solve their differences through dialogue and negotiations and prioritize the interests of our nation.
Chaos creates a perfect opportunity for robbery. Our country needs peace. I'm now sick of this. We're in a very disgusting time. I'm telling you the truth.
Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed launched a military offensive in the northern Tigray region, accusing the opposition-led local government of attacking federal troops and looting their assets. The region's ruled by the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF.
Today, the apostate Ethiopian has stabbed Ethiopia. What makes this attack one of the most shocking attacks is that TPLF is viewing the Ethiopian National Defense Forces as a foreign army. I declare that we Ethiopians will do all we can to shame and destroy this force.
Abiy declared a six-month state of emergency in Tigray and shut down electricity, phone and internet services there. In a statement aired on Tigray TV, a regional government spokesman accuses the Nobel Prize-winning prime minister of cowing the people of Tigray into submission by force. Tensions between the two sides escalated in September when Tigray went ahead with regional elections despite a ban from the federal government. Abiy postponed the polls, citing the coronavirus pandemic, but the TPLF says he delayed them to stay in power. The TPLF dominated Ethiopian politics for more than three decades and says Abiy squeezed them out of the federal government when he came to power in 2018. Analysts warn the conflict in Tigray could turn into a civil war.
This could also lead to the destabilization and the fracturing of Ethiopia's military, because Tigrayan officers, particularly based in Tigray, are thought that they may not be loyal to the federal government in terms of its efforts to remove the TPLF leadership. So this could lead to a broader crisis throughout Ethiopia, and it could also spread to the Horn of Africa region.
The UN has called on both sides to de-escalate tensions and find a peaceful solution to the dispute. The Secretary General underlined the importance of stability for Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa, a region with a long history of border conflicts and political unrest. Emily Hsu, Al Jazeera.
All right, let's bring in our guests from London. Awal Alo, a senior lecturer at Keele University and a Horn of Africa analyst. From Addis Ababa is Zadig Abraha, the Ethiopian minister in charge of democratization. And also from London is Martin Plaut, a senior research fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Thank you all for joining us. Zadig, let me start with you today. Prime Minister Abe said that the federal military operations in the north have, quote, clear, limited, and achievable objectives. Where do things stand there now, and what are those objectives?
The objectives are loud and clear. As you may be aware of, our northern command base has been raided by the TPLF junta. Our artillery has been looted, and our soldiers are surrounded, which is a clear break with the rule of the law, with the law of the land. So we are there to make sure that the rule of law is upheld. The law of the land, which is the constitution, is respected. So the measure is me, and then our second objective is to make sure that our citizens living there are living there freely without the interference of the TPLF military junta. So this is the objective, and as the Prime Minister has clearly stipulated, our military operation over there is meant to achieve these two major objectives.
Awal, just how close is Ethiopia to civil war right now?
I think Ethiopia is in a state of civil war already.
What we have is an armed confrontation between the federal government forces and forces that are loyal to the regional government, a regional government that controls a large swaths of territory, a regional government that has sufficient resources and administers the country. So this is a civil war. But just to address the point that he was making earlier, that the government was forced into this confrontation, I mean, to be quite honest, we know that the writings are already on the wall that war is coming in terms of the political confrontation between the two forces. And the war in Tigray now is basically an extension of the war that the Abiy government has been prosecuting in places like Oromia. The only reason why we are here talking about armed confrontation is because TPLF, which runs the Tigray region, has an army. It controls its own region. It has resources that allows it to defend itself. But the evidence very clearly shows that there has already been provocative military deployment on the border. So if TPLF, as the Ethiopian government claiming now, tried to loot, for example, the resources of the Northern Command, it's probably because it saw that war is coming and that war is imminent, because there has been threats of use of force against them.
Martin, so what are the reasons for the conflict and why has it escalated so much? Was the tipping point for all this the holding of the election?
I think that was the immediate cause. In a sense, you can't hold an election in an area where the part of a country where the federal government says you can't hold that election, that it's illegitimate. And if you go ahead with it, it's a direct challenge to the state. But the perhaps even more directly, when the federal government attempted to send a military commander to the north to take control of the army, the Tigrayans basically told him to go home, that he wasn't going to be allowed. But if you go a little bit further back than that, you see really the disintegration of the system of government that was brought about in 1991 when the Tigrayans took control of the central government. And they brought about a system of ethnic federalism, which basically left them controlling through a series of proxies all the various regions and the peoples of Ethiopia. And that gradually fell away until you get the election of Prime Minister Abiy. And once that happened, it opened a Pandora's box and all sorts of ethnic tensions exploded.
Zadig, I know you were eager to jump in and respond to some of what Awal had said. Please go ahead.
The way I will characterize the ongoing operation in Tigray is very wrong. If one is to call what's happening a civil war, in the strictest sense of the term, carries the weight of a war between people, like among people, which is not the case here. This is a conflict between a federal government that is trying to uphold rule of law in Tigray and a rogue military junta that is trying to keep the good people of Tigray away from the rest of the country by way of massacre, looting banks, and so on. So this is not anywhere closer to civil war. And this is not an extension of what is happening in Oromia or somewhere else. You know, we are trying to make Ethiopia a democratic success against all odds, as the reform has brought about a number of challenges. And as a country that has been out there looking for a possible democratic government, we know what this brings about. So what's happening in Oromia or in the south, this is a normal challenge. And the way we are responding to the challenge is, we believe, the right way to do. There is no this kind of attack against our military bases in Oromia or in the south. So this is not closer. This is not an extension of what's happening in Oromia or in the south. And this is not also in any way a civil war. This is simply the people of Tigray are against this, against the move by the TPLF. Whenever our army makes its way in Dansha or in some other part of the region, now the people are coming out in mass and welcoming our army. It shows that the people of Tigray are not behind this attack on our Northern Command base.
It would be interesting. It's really interesting to hear Zadig as minister responsible for democratization saying what he was just said. The prime minister dissolved the former governing EPRDF party and created a new party that does not reflect existing fault lines in the country, that does not reflect existing social cleavages or the kind of predominant modes of organizing and mobilization that exists in the country. He changes the party in a very rushed way in December of last year. By May, he realized that there is no way that that party could win anything resembling a competitive election. So the prime minister used the public health emergency in relation to COVID to postpone the election. Now, after essentially eliminating every kind of powerful or formidable political adversary within Oromia, which is the most significant region, after eliminating and jailing everybody, the prime minister is saying, now we can go for election, even though the initial justification, which is COVID, has not been dealt with. Mm. The numbers are going up. More people are dying. So you can see that the difference between these two forces is ultimately political. It is ideological. It's ideological in the sense that we have a prime minister that is determined to impose his own vision of the future on the Ethiopian people. He wants to make the Ethiopian state great again, an idea which is opposed by a significant majority in that country. And you have, on the other hand, people who are opposed to that vision. Now, in terms of TPLF, I have to say that the TPLF, who is the architect of the current political settlement, mismanaged that project. They dishonored that project. Zadig was a member of that party. He has been an ideologue for that party for a long period of time. He knows that situation. The question is not so much that TPLF is here some kind of saint, but the war itself is very much a reflection of the ideological difference between the two actors, and it should not have morphed into an armored confrontation of this sort. And the reasons that the government is giving is really not the real reason behind the war.
Mm. Martin, I want to take a step back here for a moment, because Zadig, I'm sorry, I will get back to you as soon as I've asked Martin another question, then I'll give you a chance to respond. I know you wanted to respond to Martin and also to some of what Awal is saying. Let me just ask Martin this question first. Martin, I want to take a step back, as I was saying. You know, the Tigrayans have held a great deal of power since 1991. Since Prime Minister Abe has come to power, has he sidelined the TPLF or the Tigrayans, or has he just attempted to redistribute power among Ethiopia's various ethnic groups?
No, I mean, he has definitely sidelined the Tigrayans, and they feel that, I mean, very much so. But, I mean, you know, there was a very good point made by one of my colleagues, and he said that the government's argument that this is a just war comes down to a very specific claim that ethnic conflict and political violence since April 2018 has occurred because the TPLF, the Tigrayans, have planned and executed it. To win this argument, concrete evidence will have to be made public. And that is really at the heart of what they're having to show. If the Prime Minister Abiy believes that there is direct evidence that the Tigrayans have been behind every single one of the problems that there have been across the country, let him show it. One more challenge, let the Ethiopians and the Tigrayans allow reporters, independent reporters, both from Ethiopia and from the international community, to go up to the front lines and witness what's going on for themselves, and end the cutting off of telecommunications with Tigray. Let information flow. Then we'll begin to know what's really going on.
All right, Zadig, please go ahead. I know you wanted to jump in before. Here's your chance to respond.
Okay, I want to first tackle what Awal has said. You know, EPRDF, Awal is saying that the Prosperity Party, the newly established party, which is a continuation of PRDF in some sense, is established by the prime minister. This is very wrong. The prime minister is part and parcel of the effort to change EPRDF into Prosperity Party. So it is not only the prime minister's vision. It is a shared vision among the rank and file of the Prosperity Party. And Awal said the difference between TPLF and Prosperity Party is ideological difference. That is very wrong. Is attacking our Northern Command, is attacking our soldiers, an ideological difference. It can never be the case. It is simply an attempt by the terrorist group to impose its will on our military base, which rejected its call, a time and again call, to join its resistance. And Prosperity Party is established in a way that aggregates the problems here, the problems in the country. It's aware of the fault lines, and I'm the way our program is designed is in a way that solves our long-standing problems. If PRDF's program was meant to solve our long-standing problems, it would have solved it. What we are seeing is because the PRDF didn't solve our problems, it simply worsened or postponed it to some other time. And Awol also said that the election was postponed for wrong reasons. That's very wrong. You know, 50 plus countries have postponed the election due to COVID-19. And it was not our will. We wanted to go out for the election and compete openly. But it is up to the National Electoral Board to do so. The National Electoral Board felt due to COVID, Ethiopia is not ready for election. So we were forced. We were part of members of these parties who said, who opposed the decision of the National Electoral Board. You know, National Electoral Board is chaired by Bertura Mbeksa, a non-opposition figure, and nobody can question her credibility. And she's more credible than any of us. So this is not our will. This is the will of the National Electoral Board, and we were meant to accept it. And now, you know, COVID has become a way of life. You don't have a proof that it will go away someday. Nobody has a proof that we'll be able to get the vaccine anytime soon. So we cannot postpone the Ethiopian people's right to vote for unlimited number of time, like for undetermined number of time. And it's even now, it is not up to us. The National Electoral Board came up with a solution that, since we have learned a lot, since we have come to know how to live with COVID, then we can go ahead with the election and make it happen in 9 months' time. So, and we are subserving ourselves to the decision of the National Electoral Board, together with the parliament. It is against the truth of the ground.
All right, Zadig, I can see
and
now
I
that
want, I want to tackle what Martin said.
We're starting to run out of time. Yes. Let me get back to you with another question in a few minutes. You can respond to what Martin said, but I want to go to Awol now because he wanted to jump in and respond to some of what you were saying just now. Go ahead, Awol.
It's astonishing that people like Zadig or the Prime Minister would tell us what is so wrong with the TPLF regime or with the EPRDF regime. These people were an integral part of the EPRDF regime. Zadig was one of the ideologues. The Prime Minister, he was one of the people, he was a minister, he was responsible for one of the security agencies in that country. Now, it is easy, having served in that regime, now to say that that regime has dishonored the constitution, was not committed to democratization. But what reason do we have to believe that the people who are now running the country are actually committed to democratization when we see on the ground practices that are completely the opposite of what they say? That is said, the electoral board is independent. There is no evidence to show that the electoral board is actually independent. The prime minister is in control of the government, and most of the things that are happening in the country are happening precisely because he mismanaged the transitional process. He mismanaged the transitional process in the sense that while he was given a very specific mandate when he came to power, I think it's important to understand that this prime minister was not elected, that he was selected by the party after a popular protest by the Oromo youth forced the then prime minister to resign. When he was selected by his party, he was given a very specific, very limited mandate, which is to lead the country through transition to democracy while building political consensus and promoting national reconciliation. That was the mandate that he was given. And instead of doing that, the prime minister basically presented himself as somebody who got a fresh mandate from the electorate, and he started making interventions that have a constitutional implication. He wanted to recreate the Ethiopian state. He wanted to push the political settlement in a different direction. That is what is at the core of the problem that we see now. But in terms of this violence that is being blamed against the TPLF and other forces, I think it's important to highlight that while one cannot rule out that TPLF might have an interest in instigating violence, At the same time, there are reasons to believe that the government might be behind some of the violence that we see. When in Shahjahmani, for example, a significant number of people were killed, security forces were simply standing there and watching. They said, we have not been instructed to intervene. Now, as somebody who grew up in Ethiopia, I know that it is a country where kind of law and order culture runs deep. Security forces would actually want to enforce law and order even when they are not on duty. So when you look at events such as that, when you look at, for example, the way in which the recent violence in the Wollaga region has been spinned by the government, there are reasons to suspect that the government may be behind some of this violence. I'm not saying that there is a clear evidence, but when they accuse TPLF and other forces, they are expected to come forward with evidence so that people would be able to judge. But there are also reasons to suspect that the government may be behind some of this.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I know Zadig's been trying to get in a point. He wanted to respond to something Martin said. Zadig, please go ahead, but please be mindful. We don't have much time left, and I'd like to try to get Martin's thoughts on what you have to say about his response earlier as well. Go ahead.
Okay. One thing I want to get straight, corrected is we are not the ones that interrupted the telecommunication connectivity in Tigray. It is a TPLF regime through its apparatus that interrupted the telecommunication connectivity. And the government has no problem subscribing itself to an independent review, and we have been availing it for that. But I also want to respond to what Awol has been saying. You know, we are part of the regime, but we, the prime minister and other people, other officials, including myself, asked our people for an apology, and we were given the chance to get our record straight. And the difference between us and the TPLF is here. TPLF chose not to be part of a new political settlement, not to subscribe itself for a call to a fair share of power.
Zadig,
rather, the TPLF is so used to privilege that.
Zadig, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Just that we're really almost out of time, and I want to ask Martin here as well a last question. I want to know from your perspective, Martin, how likely is it that Eritrea's military gets pulled into this now?
I think that is a real danger. We have seen some reports that people with Eritrean Eritreans have been found on the battlefield in uniform. That cannot be corroborated yet. And there are also some suggestions of mobilization inside Eritrea. As I say, this cannot be corroborated. But let me just put one point to you, which is that there's been a warning from the United States Institute of Peace, which includes people like Chet Kroetker and Johnny Carsons, the former Assistant Secretary of State for Africa. Both of them warn of the danger of a collapse of the Ethiopian state, the largest state collapse in modern history. That's what they're saying is possible. This is a really, really dangerous position. And, you know, the idea that it could reach across the region makes it even more serious. I think people have to be very, very concerned about what's going on.
All right, we've run out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much to all our guests, Awol Alo, Zadig Abraha, and Martin Plaut.
So that just about wraps it up for us here at Amandla. I'd like to remind you that we have a wonderful blog where you can check out the best of Amandla, and that's at amandla.ca. And Doug, I really wanted to thank you so much for pulling this together and your comments in particular around Remembrance Day and war and peace, you know, particularly relevant and moving. And this year, Heldon kicked off a focus on youth in Africa, and we've committed to kind of following that up in its various facets over the next few months. And I think that when we think about Remembrance Day and talk about war and peace, we do really have to have a special focus on youth and young people who are moving into a world according to structures that were not of their own making, but where they are the primary victims. So,
and African youth form more than 50% of the population of Africa, and have picked up that baton in Nigeria, in Sudan, in Algeria. I mean, so yes, we will focus on them, and they are our peacemakers of the decade coming up.
Stay tuned now for Jazz Euphorium.
CKUT, Henry Grimes, and stay tuned for more of the most aesthetic things, feelings in the world.
Red alert. The spread of COVID-19 is at a critical level in your area or a neighboring region. Getting together with family or friends is prohibited, and traveling to other regions is not recommended. More targeted restrictions have been put into place to limit the spread and prevent a lockdown. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Continue to wash your hands, keep a 2-meter distance, and wear a mask when physical distancing is impossible. We need to act now. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.